accession number 20456, reel 30.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 13. You were saying that division had told you to keep the Berkshires on top of the hill.
Yes.
Did you actually manage to get up to see the Berkshires?
No.
You were just stuck on the side of the...
Well, I was stuck on the side of a precipice. Mm.
Do you have any idea what sort of positions they managed to get into? Did they...
No. No. Mm.
Who took over in the Royal Welsh then when their colonel was...
Very nice chap who had been brigade major of 5 Brigade called Jack Stocker, who was South South Borderer, and he commanded them for the rest of the Burma campaign.
What happened to them pro tem, though? Because presumably, I mean, did he have to come forward, or was he already with them when...
No, he had to come across. Mm. He was on the other side of the valley. He was at, with 5 Brigade on 5020. Mm. And he was told to pack up his job and take over. He was, in fact, Brigade Major of 5 Brigade at the time, I think, yes.
So he was posted into this battalion that had had a very bad time. He must have faced an extremely difficult situation taking over the Royal Welsh.
Indeed. And the extraordinary thing was, in a fortnight or so, you wouldn't have known anything had happened. Mm.
But they had recovered.
Well, he was, they were a very good battalion there, the first Royal Welsh, you know. It's rather like being sort of caught, on a slippery slope unknown by someone who knocks you over very quickly, and before you know, you've had it. That battalion in the Royal Welsh was there, was fought brilliantly.
What could you do in order to ameliorate and improve things during the time you were waiting for the new brigade to turn up?
I just held on, by one's eyebrows, hoping that the Japanese didn't rumble what had gone on.
Were they trying to clear you off the ridge?
No, they weren't funny. They had odd patrol clashes with the Berkshires. There was no great attack or anything on them, no.
No big push?
No. Mm. I think they find it equally difficult to get up there anyway.
Oh. So I think by the end of the month you said the Japanese began to withdraw. How was that indicated? Was it patrol reports?
Yes. It was one of the Gurkha battalions that did it. Where's the book? Fourth First Gurkhas.
How did they operate? Did they come up through your...
No, it's the other side. The other side of the village, as it were.
Yes.
Where are we? Yes, 25th of May, the 4th First Gurkhas went to a particular place the Japanese had been holding very successfully and found it empty. The Japanese had gone. They couldn't think why. They somehow managed to infiltrate between Japanese positions and turn them off, basically 502 Air, and cleared Naga Village. And that sort of was the key to hold the rest situation, because the Japanese supply line came up through Naga Village, and they couldn't get on the main road, not really. And so that meant that they themselves were about to be cut off from their, well, non-existent supplies.
They didn't have the option of air resupply, did they?
The what? No, nothing like that at all. No, nothing.
Had you had any previous intimations of the Japanese weakening? And
No, we had not. After that, yes, it was obvious.
What happened then after this position was broken and the Japanese were withdrawn?
Well, then the whole front gradually crumbled. And we, the 2nd Division, went down the main road. And the 7th Division went down what they call the jeep track, which the Japanese had come up. And so you had two divisions going down towards Imphal on two different axes. Ours was most important, because that was the one that the eventual supplies would have to come down.
What part did 6th Division take in this?
What?
What part was 6th Brigade taking part?
What was it doing? Well, after we took the highest point, which is a place called Mao Song San, which was a pass between Kohima and Imphal. 5th Brigade then did a brilliant operation at the next sort of big delaying space. And we then went through 5th Brigade right up to mile 109 when we met the Imphal garrison coming out the other way.
Did you encounter roadblocks or other resistance on the way?
Oh, yes, we did, very much so. But by which time we'd got quite good at carrying them. And we were able to bust through them very much quicker than the Japanese thought we could.
When the Japanese set up a roadblock or blocking position, what would it consist of? How would they have it laid out?
Well, of course, basically speaking, in this case, they merely blew the little culvert between the two ridges, which meant you could not get any wheel transport across or tanks. And they sat on the far edge and tried to hold you up, you know, rebuilding what they'd blown.
What sort of strength would they be in normally on such a...
Well, very little, really. Nishida was commanding them. I think they had a whole battalion, more or less, to do it. And they did brilliantly.
What sort of positions did they create then to cover their...
Well, of course, these were nothing like the big bunkers that they had at Kohima. They were very much sort of individual foxholes, but well camouflaged. No, still had problems.
How did you go about actually clearing them? Because you said you got...
Well, you've got about them, you see.
They
were now getting short of men. So what you did was you held them in front and you just climbed up the valley hill and came down behind them.
So it fixed them in the front and then take them from the higher flank.
Yes. They just did not have enough men to hold high enough up, as it were.
How long would it normally take you to clear such a blocking position?
Usually about a day by the time you came up against the block. They had a battle place called Maram. The Worcesters had about 3 days, where they had a much more open, much easier place to defend. But Maram was the one major battle between after Kohima and the actual breakthrough.
When you did such an attack, did you normally do it off the line of march as an improvised attack, or did you normally stop, make an appreciation, and put in a formal attack?
Well, you had to. Yes, that's exactly. The drill was that you stopped and you immediately diverted up the hill, you know, immediately.
What sort of strength would you send up the hill?
Oh, a couple of companies, maybe. Mm. They were getting very, very, very short of men by then. And, you know.
What about artillery support? Were you able to coordinate?
Oh, yes, very much so. Right. I mean, the little story of the, which you've read about the Corps Commander of Royal Artillery and the guns that Bill Simmel into action. Mm. I mean, at times these guns were firing at them from one crest to another, literally over open sights.
What would be the distance between crests on such a shoot?
Well, I mean, 3,000 yards, you know. Mm. I think machine gun range.
Very easy for guns.
Oh, yes.
What about the Japanese artillery? Were they still able
to... We hardly saw any by then.
Did they still have mortars?
A few. And they were, by now, they were an army in total disarray. Mm. Didn't mean to say that individual units wouldn't fight, but they'd lost command system. They were without rations. They were in a pretty sad state.
Did this have a noticeable effect upon the demeanour or mood of your own troops? Did they pick up the idea that the Japanese were on the run? And
oh, yes. Oh, yes, very much so.
You mentioned that you had a visit from Slim on the 18th of June and you had an argument with him.
What was that about? Yes. Well, you see, this was, again, one of the roadblocks set up, and he came up to see what was going on. And he and Bill Smith were very great chums, and he was talking to me, and he was saying, well, of course, it's different from what happened to you in Malaya, you know, because the big thing was in the 1940-41 battle, without wireless, without air supply, without anything like that, the road was the most important tactical feature. You had to hold the road to get your supplies up and down, wounded away. And Bill Smith said, well, he said, we don't bother about the road now. We've got our supply, we've got this and the rest, you see. And I said, but sir, you know, if the road is not all that important, why are we being rushed to open the road to him far? It must be important. So he laughed at me and he said, you shouldn't argue with army commanders. But it was true, you see. I mean, the road had lost, yes, it had lost its importance, but not all that much, because Bill Slim knew very well that half his aeroplanes were going to be withdrawn as soon as the Americans could get them back.
But it was a relative loss of importance, not an absolute loss of importance.
Well, you couldn't supply a whole corps, which was what they had it in for, without proper road convoys.
And there's also the question of evacuating the wounded.
That's another thing.
And bringing up reinforcements.
Exactly.
Can't do that by airdrop, can you?
No, well, you can't.
You mentioned Bill Smith. Did he join you when you were stuck on the side of the spur?
Bill Smith took over 3 days after the Royal Welsh debacle, yes. And, well, the Royal Welsh and John Chaplin being wounded, yes, correct.
What did he do? What was the first thing he did when he arrived?
I can't remember now. He was a very informal, he was a marvelous guy. He sort of said, well, what's the situation? And I told him, and he said, well, let's go and see what we can do about it. There wasn't very much. He certainly couldn't go up the hill to see the Royal Berkshires. But eventually, I mean, once he concentrated the brigade, he got to know them as quick as he could, which was very quickly indeed. He was a typical highly professional Australian soldiers, Bill Smith. On the one hand, very informal. On the other hand, highly organised.
What happened once you linked up with the troops from Imphal?
We were, for about a month, set to clear out any pockets of Japanese that had been left behind in our advance down the road. It didn't take very long, but, you know, one meant deep patrols in the hills. And this is where something rather nasty happened. For the first time, we came across scrub typhus. And that was very nasty, because, funnily enough, the Australians had just come across it at the same time in New Guinea. But no one quite knew what it was then. And you got to the stage where people were reluctant to take patrols out in the valleys because of this bloody scrub typhus tick.
What were the symptoms of scrub typhus?
Well, very high temperature and death was occurring.
How long would it take for a man to die once he...
I can't remember, about 4 or 5 days, I think. It struck us and the Australians in New Guinea at about the same time in 1944.
Was there any treatment available?
Oh, yes, there was. I forget who it was, I don't know. But I mean, but we had quite one or two deaths. Quite a lot of people who got very, very sick with it.
What about the Japanese? Did you find large numbers of them?
Oh, yes. Totally, totally starving, in a dreadful state. I've never seen anything like it.
What did you do with them?
Nothing much you could do. Mostly they died. I mean, some of them were evacuated, I believe. But I mean, they mostly either died or killed themselves.
What were they dying of? Was it wounds? Was it starvation?
Oh, wounds, malnutrition,
disease.
Starvation, disease, you name it. They'd got the lot. The trouble, I mean, everyone thought the Japanese, all they could live off rice. They can't. You can't live off rice. You've got to have other things besides rice. And they hadn't got anything else to eat. I'm told that the Imphal disaster was the biggest disaster that ever hit the Japanese army, ever, in casualties.
Did you manage to pick up many prisoners during this?
Very few, phase? Yes.
What happened to them? Were they just pushed backwards?
The what?
What happened to them? Were they just pushed
well,
backwards?
Well, we pushed them back. I mean, I don't... we had the prisoner, what you might call it, I'm trying to remember the name of the Louis Allen was one of them. There were special interrogation people who... looked after them. We didn't deal with them. We had no one to do so.
You mentioned that after the Kohima battle was over, you went back to Milestone 82. 82, yes. What was at Milestone 82?
Well, Milestone 82 was now the battle. It was rather a nice open bit of countryside, where it was easier to set up camps. One of the things we had to do at Milestone 82 was get rid of most of our motor transport and train the boys with mules. It was a nice, healthy spot, as it were. Lovely place.
Why were you exchanging motor transport for mules? What was the reason?
Well, because the next bit of the campaign that we were going to take part in, we didn't want to overburden ourselves with motor transport. In that sort of country, a mule is a much more efficient means of carrying things than a 1,500 weight truck.
Is that simply because of the form
well,
of the ground?
They're roads. You know, you're operating in jungle tracks and up mountainsides and things.
You mentioned also that in this period you were absorbing reinforcements.
That's it. They were breaking up. Originally, there were a lot of... we have found, I think, we had too many gunners, anti-aircraft regiments and things, and they were sort of broken up and sent us infantry reinforcements.
How did they get on? Did they fit into the...
Perfectly well. And once the initial shock wore...
How long did that take for the initial shock?
Well, the British Army being totally sort of tribal, to be taken out of your tribe and sent to another tribe with a different vocabulary, it's dreadful. they didn't mind.
Had they been given a retraining to make them into infantry?
No, we trained them.
You trained them?
Yeah.
How long did they normally take to pick up the essential
skills? Well, we weren't very long, you see. They originally had infantry training before they became gunners. No. You see, we weren't in action as a division again till about Christmas, so there were something like 4 months where they could be absorbed into their own units and so on.
Another thing you mentioned is that you were getting yourself fit again.
Well, I'd had damaged chap let off a gun very nearly, and damaged this ear very badly indeed. And I'd also had malaria very badly, and both Cam Nicholson and Bill Smith decided that, you know, it was about time I had a bit of a rest, so that they sent me back to England on Staff College.
Were you feeling at that time that it was time you had a bit of a rest and a change?
I don't think I noticed at the time. Afterwards I did, yes.
So it's only in retrospect you realised?
No, in retrospect. I mean, you see, one was stuffed with malaria or these anti-malarial pills and mepocrine and stuff. It was a way of life.
What about the health of the soldiers in the brigade generally? I mean, did you...
Well, that is a remarkable thing. The doctors, since 1941-42, the medical services had so improved and the various treatments had so improved, the health was very, very good.
You mentioned Nicholson, the new divisional commander. How did he compare to his predecessor?
Oh, he was quite different. They were both delightful chaps. Cam Nicholson was a big, huge, big gunner. He was a charmer. But somehow, that's who you ask. He was never regarded, although he was very much liked, in quite the same way as we thought of John Grover. John Grover commanded Division 3 years, you see, and that was a trouble. I think he almost knew the name of every man in that division. And of course, when you have casualties, it hurt.
How did you get back to England?
On a troop ship. What was she called? She was a big, big ex-pioneer. Bombay. Yeah. Strathaven. Marvellous. Super trip. I must say I found England a very strange place to come back to. I'd been away for 8 years.
I was going to ask you about what impressions you had of England after your long absence.
Well, you almost felt like a man from Mars. Well, you see, so many of my contemporaries were either in the forces or killed. You know, you came back to stay with an aged generation of uncles and aunts and things.
What about the general condition of the country and its mood when you got back?
I don't know. I noticed all that much about it, except that everyone you met was in uniform of one sort or another. As I say, it was a strange feeling.
Would this be a feeling of nostalgia or deja vu or something of that sort? Returning.
I think nostalgia. I think that having been in a sort of, well, if you can think of the army as a semi-religious community, you know, in regiments and things, you felt a bit alone, you know. You hadn't got anyone.
The army does provide an instant social life, doesn't it?
Well, I want to say that, you know, the last the war years were all social, but I mean, you weren't short of sort of friends and contemporaries. And you had, you know, been through quite a lot together, one way and another. And here you were, sort of, on your own for the first time for 8 years.
Did that feeling of being on your own disappear once you joined the Staff College at Cambridge?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was like going back to school again.
Yeah. Back to school?
Yes. Oh, yes. You were treated like school. Or Sandhurst, you were treated like schoolboys, you know.
Where were you based? Were you in Camberley or Minley?
Minley.
Or Minley?
Mm. Much the best.
In the manor house?
Oh, lovely place. Mm. And Minley considered itself far superior to Camberley.
Do you remember what was on the syllabus of the staff course?
Oh, yes, I think so. I don't think it had changed very much for years. Many of the same exercises. John Masters describes it so well in his book, you know, exactly the same sort of exercise, doing the same thing. Having been on the staff as a brigade major,
without having done the staff course
before, one found an awful lot of the staff course rather easy, you know, because you've done it, or done something like it, really like it. On the other hand, there were things one knew nothing about, for example, warfare in Europe or the desert, nothing. And to that exchange, one was a rather sort of odd body, because most of the students either had come from Europe or, you know, down the desert or Italy.
You must have been in a very small minority. Yeah,
we were. Out of the whole course, if there were 20 of us who had been in Burma, we were lucky, I think. Yeah.
Did you find that the other officers on the course were interested in what had been going on in Burma?
Oh, yes. I mean, we were all interested in what was going on everywhere. And you see, this was the first, it was the second regular course. Once the war started, quite rightly, the army, this is what I've been told, got hold of their young officers, ex-business, and trained them, you know, staff, through the staff college. And they thought, well, okay, the regulars we can catch out of any time we like. And I was on the actual second course in the whole of the war that had nothing but young regulars. So most of us had all been at Sandhurst together, you know.
You're all the same generation.
We're all the same generation, yeah, yeah, which is all nice.
What were the methods of instruction?
The syndicate, basically the syndicate discussions, they haven't changed, I don't think, lectures. And that was another thing, that although our so-called directing staff instructors wore the badges of lieutenant colonels and were a bit older than us, in certain cases they did not necessarily have the same experience as we had. So that the methods of instruction are very much discussions round a table, with no one saying, now, this is what you've got to do, or this is the doctrine. They say, well, how else did you manage to do it?
Besides syndicate discussion and lectures, did you have any practical exercises?
Oh, yes, very much so. Oh, yes. Again, some of them, I'm told, pre-war. Again, for years. I mean, one had big exercises, probably took a week, and you were divided into sub-syndicates of, say, three people, and you had to produce your own solution. I had an advantage, I could type. So, you know, one was able to produce a reasonable sort of thing. And also meant that you could coordinate the thing, because if you were the typist, you would say, you can't write that, you've got to write this, or whatever it is.
But was there a lot of written work to produce?
There was quite a lot of written work, yes.